Welcome to the podcast of Greenlight Bookstore. This is the quarantine season. While Greenlight isn't currently hosting in-person gatherings, we're still striving for ways to create connection around books. Thanks to the gracious efforts of authors and interviewers scattered across the country and the world, we've taken our events programming online, hosting live readings, conversations, and audience questions via Zoom. Our podcasts this season are a record of those intimate conversations between thinkers and creators speaking from separate rooms, and a window into the ways that ideas and stories connect us all. Once you've listened to the conversation, you can purchase the books mentioned in this podcast at Greenlight's two bookstore locations in Brooklyn or on our website at greenlightbookstore.com.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's live online author event with Greenlight Bookstore. I'm Chelsea from Greenlight. And we're thrilled to host tonight's event with Daniel Lodell, presenting his new book, Hades Argentina. He'll be talking with Phil Klei, so you're in for an excellent time. Before we start, I just want to say a huge thank you to Daniel, Phil, and the team at Riverhead for making this happen, and to all of you for showing up. Though we're not able to host events in our store spaces, our community of authors and readers is still here. We're grateful for your support and for the chance to make this space for conversation and connection. We'll be pulling questions only from the Q&A to be answered in the later part of the program. We are recording tonight's event, so look for video or audio versions on our social media channels later on. And importantly, tonight's featured book, Hades Argentina, is available for sale from Greenlight Bookstore. You can shop in person in our bookstore locations, noon to 7 p.m. every day of the week, and you can purchase Daniel's book and many others on site. Or order online at greenlightbookstore.com for a quick pickup at the store or for shipping anywhere in the U.S. If you care about supporting the careers of authors and the ongoing existence of independent bookstores, buying tonight's featured book is a great way to show your support. And we're fortunate that Daniel was able to stop by our Fort Greene store earlier this week to autograph copies of Hades Argentina. So you can find those at the store or order them online while supplies last. Just indicate your signed copy request in the order comments field at checkout. Now to introduce tonight's speakers. Our interviewer tonight is Phil Klei. He's a graduate of Dartmouth College and a veteran of the U.S. Marine Corps. Klei is the author of the novel Missionaries and the New York Times best-selling short story collection Redeployment, which won the National Book Award for Fiction in 2014. Redeployment also received the Marine Corps Heritage Foundation's James Webb Award for fiction dealing with U.S. Marines or Marine Corps life, the National Book Critics Circle John Leonard Award for best debut work in any genre, and many other prizes. He was also named a National Book Foundation 5 Under 35 honoree. Klei's writing has appeared in the New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, Newsweek, and the Brookings Institution Brookings Essay Series. We'll be speaking with our featured author, Daniel Lodell. He's a book editor based in Brooklyn, New York, and our neighbor here in Fort Greene, Clinton Hill neighborhood. Hades Argentina, his first novel, was inspired by his family history. His new book, Hades Argentina, is a gripping, ingeniously narrated literary debut that raises profound questions about the sometimes impossible choices we make in the name of love. The book has received praise from acclaimed authors like Oro Kwan, Elliot Ackerman, Juan Gabriel Vasquez, and tonight's interviewer, Phil Klei, who says Hades Argentina brilliantly explores the fault lines between heroism and complicity, guilt and trauma, and love and betrayal. Daniel Lodell has written a haunting and beautiful novel. Daniel is going to start us off with a reading from the book, and then he'll be talking with Phil and with all of you. Daniel, please take it away.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me. So this is the beginning of chapter 3, pretty early on, when Tomas, the protagonist, has just reconnected with Isabel, someone from his past that he was in love with and who was disappeared during the dirty war in Argentina, and he explains in a way his relationship with her. Isabel was my first love, and in some ways our relationship was as simple and as complicated as that. We met because of Pichuca. A childhood friend of my mother's, Pichuca had moved from La Plata to Buenos Aires when she married and stayed when she and her husband separated. My mother had recently suffered her own marital trauma, my father's unforeseen death from an allergic reaction to an antibiotic. And in an attempt to maintain a sense of family that had been illusory to begin with, she organized a summer vacation at Pichuca's house in Pinamar. To entice me, my mother informed me Pichuca had two daughters about my age. At first, Nerea was the one my fantasies pinned themselves on. She was 12 like me, and her Basque name referred to the Nereids of the sea, making it hard for me not to put it next to mine and imagine a match. Then I met Isabel. She was only a year older, but she seemed lifetimes more worldly and wise. One of our first days on the beach, I hustled past the begging children in the parking clearance and glanced back to see that Isabel had stopped to chat with them. Afterward, feeling a need to justify myself, I said I'd walked on because I had no change on me. Isabel told me she didn't either. "We can give more than money, don't you think?" she said, and it was clear all of a sudden we could. Another day, as we sat together in the sandy living room, she asked me point blank how I felt about my father's death. It was a topic my overly protective mother never touched. "How do I feel?" I repeated, dumbfounded, and she laughed. "I'm sure you feel something. Everybody does." I'd never encountered anyone who felt as much as Isabel did. When she was happy, she seemed 10 notches more ecstatic than I'd ever been, splashing in the water like an unruly child and laughing so wildly she snorted. When she was upset, she picked bruising fights with her mother and took long, sulking walks along the dunes for which she offered no explanation. The first few times I asked to come with her, she didn't answer or she declined. But once I went anyway. Isabel remained silent, shrugging in response to my questions until I went silent too. Then, without warning, she started jumping away from the water, lapping at our ankles, and we turned it into a game, dodging the waves as if they were sent by the evil world just for us, and together we could escape them. I joined her on all her walks after that. We never repeated that game. One time I tried, and instead Isabel turned to the water and walked right in. But the experience opened a door between us. Our heart-to-hearts were probably no more than the usual teenage schmaltz, but to me they seemed cataclysmically special. We bonded over loneliness as if we ourselves had discovered the concept and dreamed aloud about finding romantic partners with characteristics that to me sounded strikingly like each other's: honest, committed, unafraid. The main narrative was that we both felt like orphans. Though we still had our mothers, the absence of our fathers weighed heavily on us. Hers had left during the clampdown on universities that followed Onganía's coup in 66, taking a job and a lover in New York, and it made a rebel of her. While I felt alienated, alone in the universe, she seemed constantly embattled by it. We hardly left each other's side that summer, making little effort to keep poor Nerea from feeling her third wheel status. We even started addressing each other as cousins. I called her prima, while she used the diminutive primito for me. By the end of the season, I was sure I was in love. And on one of our last nights together, stealing off to the beach after everyone else had gone to bed, I tried to kiss her. Isabel rebuffed me. "We're cousins, Tomas," she said. "No, we're not." "Well, we might as well be." For a time, it seemed a self-fulfilling pronouncement. The following year, our relationship was confined to letters, and in correspondence, we retreated into cordiality and banal jokes. Isabel even confided that she'd developed a crush on someone, an older boy in her school, which was such a betrayal that I had to invent a redhead named Susanna to get back at her. Susanna was made up, but others weren't. I soon developed real crushes of my own, and Isabel spent the following summer in the States with her father, so I didn't see her again until I was 14 and she was 15. By then, I felt like a different person. I was getting top marks in school. I'd had a growth spurt. I'd fooled around girls while their parents were downstairs. Enough time had passed that all possibilities seemed to have shifted on its axis. Later, when I moved to Buenos Aires in 76, it was the same thing. I always rediscovered her after such distance that I felt we could start over, that this time we'd get it right, or the world would. With Isabel, I never believed it was too late.
That's fantastic. Well, first off, I'll say congratulations on this debut. It's superb. It's getting the superb reviews that it deserves. And it's just a remarkable piece of work. And one thing, you know, that I wanted to start out with, and I'm very glad that you read that passage, which is so attuned to these sort of very small and delicate changes and moments. It's a beautiful sketch of this pair that becomes so important. And, you know, if you look at the reviews, you know, I think the impression people will have is, you know, this is a novel about Argentina's dirty war, about complicity and guilt and all these things. But it's also a novel that deals a lot with love, as simple and as complicated as that is. And so I suppose just want to start off, why that passage? Why did you want to begin there?
You've summed it up very well in asking the question, to be honest. This is a book that is about life during the military dictatorship in Argentina from 1976 to 1983. There are scenes in a torture center. There are scenes about, you know, fighting the dictatorship. And it feels important to me to sort of ground it in the piece of intimacy that begins this whole story. Tomas, the protagonist, is in love with a woman named Isabel, who takes it upon herself to fight this regime. And Tomas only gets involved, really, I mean, he's aligned with her politically, but primarily he gets involved because he's in love with her and he wants to feel close to her and he wants to prove himself to her. And I wanted to show in this book in general that a lot of tragedies under such circumstances begin with the very normal human life things. Falling in love as a teenager can, when living in a regime like this, change your entire life.
Yeah. You know, before we go forward, I do want to note, somebody asked in the Q&A where the link is to buy your book, and it's in the chat. It's the first thing. Please go to Greenlight, buy the book from there. If you already have the book, buy another one because you're going to want to give it to somebody, or buy other books from Greenlight. It's a wonderful bookstore, and we're really, really grateful that they're hosting this event. You know, one of the things that I think is so really powerfully done in this book, like oftentimes as Americans, when we think about war, and even the sort of tradition of war writing, you think about war as this thing that happens over there, like somebody leaves and then go away to another place where they interact with other people and they come back, right? But this is a war, this is state-sponsored terrorism. This is, you know, the Argentine government, in inclusion with the United States, targeting people it views as enemies, people it views as, you know, sort of having leftist sympathies, trade unionists, guerrilla, sort of wide range of people, right? And in a war like this, war happens not as something that's going on over there, but something that happens intimately, right? Ties of family and friendship and affection cross battle lines, right? And what in another time would be a story of romance becomes something else, right? And I think that is just really, really powerfully evoked. And there's not just the love between and affection between these two. There's also the character of the colonel. And would you talk a little bit about his sort of the genesis in the story and how he makes his appearance, which is quite something.
Yeah. So the colonel is sort of Tomas's mentor. He met Tomas while basically at a chess club. He noticed, now that feels much more trendy after Queen's Gambit. Originally, I felt like this plotline was really nerdy. But you know, he sees Tomas as a young kid who's very good at chess, and he takes an interest in him because he's sort of intelligent in a way that he doesn't encounter all the time, especially as a man in, you know, he doesn't have kids and he's a man in the military. And so here's this chance to be sort of a father figure to this kid. And much later, he is become sort of the entry point for Tomas to enter this war when Isabel asks him to spy basically at a what they call a detention center, what is in fact a torture center. And the and he cashes in, so to speak, a favor with the colonel who gets him set up there. And the colonel is, he's a fun character. He's sort of the, he's a bad guy. He's in.
You look guilty saying that.
Yes, I do. I feel guilty. I mean, he is an organizer of counterinsurgency, which is a way of, he's an organizer of state torture, but he is, very sophisticated. He's the funniest character in the book. He's very witty, and Tomas loves him. And I hope some readers at least will love him. I, as his writer, love him. And to me, the colonel, to go back to sort of your introduction to that question, Phil, is in a war, not just in a war like this that's very close to home, but in general, when thinking about sort of injustice, we often think there are, you know, evil people and good people. And while there are evildoers in the world, certainly a lot of evil is done by people that not only believe themselves good, but that we ourselves might like if we have a drink with them or listen to them banter, as, you know, the colonel is often listened to by our protagonist. And it's important. It was important to me in writing this book to acknowledge that no character was going to be fully good, and that basically no character was going to be fully evil, although jury's slightly out on that. But certainly I wanted characters who, while doing and participating in evil, unjust systems, could be sympathetic, because I think that's how the world works.
Yeah, well, I mean, it has a certain degree of realism to it. I also find it much more unsettling as a reader, in part because it has the uncomfortable feeling of truth, right? In part because as you find yourself seduced and then seduced by certain characters and then repelled, it creates a sort of uncomfortable feeling, not just a sort of question of like, what would I do in that circumstance? Or I think more pertinently, what kind of aspects of a horrific system have I made compromises with in my own life that I no longer even see in the ways that these characters don't? But they never feel safe in the way that a purely evil character would, where you feel that strong sense of distance between them, which makes it more comfortable, right, to know where you stand. Now, you have a sort of personal history that is related to this. Did you want to sort of explain?
Yeah. So my half-sister, Isabel, who obviously is the namesake for the character and the inspiration for her, whom I never knew, was disappeared in Argentina in 1978. She fought against the dictatorship, first as sort of a young political activist, and then more and more intensely to the point where she was using weapons and very engaged in the resistance. And she too is a morally complicated figure. I mean, I grew up sort of thinking of her in some ways as an innocent murdered hero. And in some ways there is truth to that. She's certainly extremely brave, extremely idealistic, a huge, sense of justice. But in sort of researching her before, even for the book, just sort of investigating who she was as a person, talking to family members, a lot of people said, she wouldn't leave Argentina for anything. She would not give up this fight for anything. And I began to form an impression of her that wasn't just purely good, but complicated. And I think it was in understanding that even in the pursuit of good, of justice, you can still fall on the other side of that moral line, that the book sort of came alive. And my understanding also of just all of these kinds of civil strife, of war, also honestly, you know, fell into place. I don't think I think it, as you say, it's really easy for us and comfortable to assume that there are good people and bad people. And to, it just doesn't work that way. And this is true of the protagonist Tomas as well. You know, he is complicit in some of the things that happen in this book. And he also loses his sense of where he stands on that moral divide.
Yeah, well, one of the things that happens, so Isabel is using him in a certain way. He's using his love for her. She doesn't love him in the same way, exactly. And she asks him to go to begin working in this torture center, right? Where he's going to enter, I mean, he's going to enter into a hellish place, become morally compromised, not just at risk, I think, in terms of his physical safety, right, by doing this work. But I think on a sort of deeper moral level, he's going to be tainted by what happens. And that's what she requests of him. And she knows that she'll get it because he loves her, right?
Yeah, and that is one of the origins of this story in a way. Isabel was murdered with her partner. The real Isabel, my half-sister, was murdered with her partner. And the impression I got from family was always that her partner, Julio, was a little less committed and more afraid than Isabel at the end of their time together, that he would have left, but that she was so determined to keep fighting that they didn't. And he essentially died, I don't know if because of her, I mean, he believed in the cause as well, but that idea that love can spill over, and that love can spill over into injustice, and that injustice can spill over into love, was sort of where the origin of this narrative happened. You know, when I heard that story, when I learned about Isabel and her partner and how they were killed, I sort of, because I didn't know what I would have done if I had been him. And I didn't know what I would have done if I had been her either, someone that determined to stay in Argentina, you know? I mean, a lot of people I know who tried to convince them to leave or have such regret that they chose not to. But everyone who knew Isabel, or most people who knew Isabel, the real Isabel, say, and the Isabel in the book, that she never would have left.
You know, I think we often have this emphasis on these kind of like, you know, the individual choices we make. But one of the things that's really interesting about the book is, you know, all these characters are trapped inside a system, right? And there's this kind of tension between individual agency and the choices that are allotted to you within a system that is fundamentally unjust, right? And there's a passage later in the book where in the conversation, we all made mistakes, Tomas. Why it's come down to yours, I don't know. I don't know why things ever come down to any one person's choices. And then the narrator reflects, maybe they don't, I considered saying. Maybe it doesn't come down to anything, and we just tell ourselves it does for the pain, so we don't have to feel so small and powerless. It sounded logical, the kind of argument the colonel might have approved of, but I could also imagine the rejoinder. Maybe we tell ourselves we're small and powerless, so we don't have to feel the pain.
I'm very glad you quoted that passage. That sort of gets at the heart of the question in this book, which is one that I do not have an answer to, which is how much individual responsibility, obviously individual responsibility matters enormously, especially when contending with things like injustice, don't get me wrong, but the degree of it is sort of confusing, and particularly when reflecting on one's life. And I think that is also a product of the way I grew up. You know, certain people took responsibility for Isabel's death, and there was a lot of regret that I knew of tangentially. And it's sort of hard to pin down how much a single choice mattered to the ultimate outcome of Isabel's life. And I think what's really hard is you, especially when you strive to be good, and then you may take a wrong turn along the path, all your reflections will be focused on that wrong turn. But it's so much bigger than that, both in terms of the system in which you're traveling and in terms of just the life you're leading. And yeah, that question was sort of the center one. I don't know even now the answer, which feels kind of good in some ways to not have an answer to that question.
The other thing, you know, there's a sort of range of really fascinating characters, and some of the more interesting characters are the other torturers, right? That Tomas finds himself working with, and you give a sort of complexity to the men and their relationship to their work. And you know, as I was reading this, you know, I tend to be interested in perpetrators, right? And there's a kind of question that is always in my mind about the sort of ethics of representation, right? When you're dealing with subjects involving so much horror and so much pain, right? And what was it? First off, was a sort of ethical question of like, how is, you know, if there is a morally right way to portray these people or to represent these people, or was your sort of focus on, I want to get this as realistic as possible, to kind of get the complexity of this environment as possible, and then hopefully the ethics is simply in presenting the reality for the, you know, for the reader to think about?
I guess it was more the latter for me. I wanted to show that people participating in something as horrible as a torture center can still not only be likable, but can seem normal. You know, I mean, they engage and do in torture with the radio on, listening to soccer games. One of them loves listening to opera while doing it. Another really likes tango. And one of them is a, you know, tells a lot of jokes, the gringo Carlitos. He's sort of like, you know, buffoon. And sorry, a cat has jumped onto my lap.
You haven't done a Zoom event for real until a cat has showed up.
The cat has shown up in business meetings, but not in virtual launch.
He wasn't going to miss it.
Yeah. But it's also funny to have that happen while talking about torturers. anyway, point being that like, the normalcy, I mean, because also this torture center, Automotores Orleti, inspired by the real Automotores Orleti, existed in the center of Buenos Aires, and it was right next to a school. And to think about how much of this cruelty is happening next to such normal events that are happening and such normal tendencies in people, like listening to the radio, you know, when in doing the research for this book, when I went to Automotores and I saw that there was a kitchen, and the tour guide said, you know, this is where the torturers had lunch every day. Of course, I immediately thought how strange that was, that these people engaged in these horrible activities are, you know, having lunch together, eating sandwiches, bantering, and to show that in what is truly scary in some ways is that people like this can turn that off and be good people or fun people or normal people in other spheres of their life. And I think that was what I really wanted to understand and show. And I think if we want to understand where these tendencies come from, you have to begin by understanding that even a torturer has a family at home and cares about what they have for lunch. It sounds banal, but that's, you know, how humans are.
And the main character is sort of our bridge between the two worlds, right? He works in the torture center. He's doing it for an ostensibly heroic purpose. He develops sort of relations with these folks, the torturers and in particular one torturee. But the novel is told from a much greater distance after he's sort of come back from a period of exile, right? And also it's clear that the novel is being told in English, right? Like there are bits actually, like in the selection that you read, where he refers, you know, the Spanish diminutive, right? And I wondered why that choice, why he's telling the story in English, and why you chose to sort of situate it as somebody after a long period of exile coming back to Argentina, and confronting all of this.
Basically because that was the emotional experience closest to me that, you know, I don't know if my father is viewing this and if he would agree, but I saw the pain around Isabel, in some ways through his lens or the lens of others who survived her. Those who had remorse, who had very conflicted feelings about either the traumas they experienced or the traumas that they escaped. That was the much closer to my experience growing up in such a household than, you know, the life Isabel lived, you know, in hiding, fighting, you know, with guns. Like I never did any of that. And so it was much easier for me to inhabit Tomas than to inhabit Isabel. And, you know, one thing we haven't talked about in this regard is, of course, you know, it is called Hades, Argentina. There is an element that it is not only told with the benefit of hindsight, but told because the narrator, Tomas, ends up re-experiencing a lot of these memories in the underworld of the disappeared and his memories, going into the actual a sort of afterlife in pursuit of the ghost of Isabel. Yeah, spoiler, sorry. And similarly in that way, you know, that people have asked me like why that device, ghosts, this is, you know, would be, you know, could be a realist novel. And it's sort of similar, you know, my experience was of growing up with a ghost, of watching the haunting of my father, of people in my family, and also of watching, of knowing South Americans, of knowing Argentines, almost all of them in America. You know, I mean, my father grew up in Argentina, lived in America for many years. He never has identified as an American, but, you know, and I watched people who experienced this loss have to distance themselves from both the loss and from the country in which it all happened, and to see it refracted almost through very strange lenses of sort of new languages in the U.S., accents, whatever, life in Queens versus La Plata, you know. And so I don't know if I ended up answering that, but that is basically why I did it through the lens of someone 10 years after these events, and why I did it in the lens of someone sort of re-experiencing them in a ghostly way.
It also allows for this sort of interesting layering. I mean, one of the things that's a very nice note that you strike as he sort of comes back, and there's this realization of like a country and a place that has not stayed you know, sort of the way that he is in his memory, where people have continued on, but what has happened has not been reckoned with, right? That sort of, you know, there's a degree of sort of widespread complicity, whether people who are very directly involved in atrocity or sort of involved at varying degrees of distance from what was happening, right? There's that line, in Argentina, you didn't get involved, you saw, but you didn't see. And then there's a sort of like living in a society where a sort of full accountability and justice is not a sort of social political possibility, and moves with the characters in the way that this, you know, the narrator has been abstracted from and then comes back to. And it sort of, you get his kind of insider knowledge from when he's there, but also the sort of culture shock that he experiences at the same time, which I thought was a sort of fascinating sort of different relationships to guilt and complicity between the sort of exile and the person who has been living with it in the country.
Yeah, the Argentina and in some ways other countries in South America are interesting in terms of looking at the aftermath of a political trauma like this. You know, unlike Germany in World War II, which was defeated, mm-hmm. and then, you know, you had new governments take over, and there were the Nuremberg trials, and there was a lot of, you know, sort of forced reconciliation of a kind with what had happened. In Argentina, in some ways, the military dictatorship won for a long time. The junta was... They eradicated the resistance. The armed resistance was gone by the end of this dictatorship. And the junta fell not from war, not because people thought they were unjust, but for merely running the economy into the ground. And the junta leaders are put on trial, but and put in prison, a few of them, but all the subordinates... a law is passed that protects all the subordinates. If you're involved in torture, if you're involved in kidnappings, if you're involved in murder, you are following orders, you're innocent. So all of these people remained at large in Argentina. The power structure that had been in place during the dictatorship largely remained the power structure for a long time, at least to varying degrees until the early 2000s. And yeah, that meant there was no reckoning with, I mean, there were degrees of reckoning. You know, there was a report on what had happened, whatever. But like, there were people in the 90s running into their torturer at a bus stop, you know, that kind of thing. And what this meant was that the silence that the dictatorship had imposed sort of in some ways culturally remained. And that, you know, things only started to sort of things have been coming to light, but they really only came to light in the early 2000s. And yeah, you end up with this weird sense in the book of Tomas comes back to a place that is in some ways just unchanged. There is no dictatorship at that moment. There are no kidnappings happening, but it's the same Argentina. It's the same Buenos Aires. There's no, you know, buildings bombed out. There's no sense that it has radically transformed. And the transformation of Argentina hasn't happened yet in that book and is still sort of in some ways ongoing even today. Trials are still happening. And anyway, this is a very rambling answer, but all of this to say that I think even for me growing up, you know, that silence permeated very widely, even across continents. You know, that we all, half Argentines, whatever, and to some extent internalized that silence. And Tomas goes back to Buenos Aires sort of reconnecting with a place that is unchanged, but in which he is alone sort of in accessing this trauma. That was far too long.
Not at all. And where he's going to get a do-over, right?
This is hope. This is a story in which Tomas is seeking redemption, both metaphorical and in some ways literal. He does get to a chance at sort of changing some of his actions in the past. That's his hope.
Much too simple a notion, your regret. Do something, don't do something, as if actions could be reduced to such measly forks in the road. The writing's good, man. I just wanted to read that line.
Well, that is the Colonel speaking, of course. My character with the most sort of witticisms and charm in the story. And
And little nuggets of truth that also are little like exculpatory for himself.
He is kind of my weird Oscar Wilde through Argentine hell lens. Yeah. That's who the Colonel is kind of supposed to be. But yes, going back to the personal responsibility question, that nugget points again to the fact that how the sum of a single of all of one's actions versus a single action, that math is incalculable even 10 years later, 40 years later.
Yeah. Though it can also be a way out of sort of accounting for the decisions that you have made, right?
Yes. Another thing the Colonel's frequently pointing out is that Tomas, our narrator, is in denial. And going back to the sort of silence and the reckoning of Argentina with all of this injustice and its both its survivors and victims alike, a lot of that reckoning is about confronting denial.
Right. So I'm gonna move to some of the Q&A. I could talk to you about this book all day, and I don't, you know.
Things are wonderful. I love that.
I also just have such a temptation to talk about how some of those things play out, such as the concept of the do-over throughout the book. But you know, no spoilers. But it's the sort of the way that the novel moves is just brilliant. Ariel asks, "What's it like to be on both sides of the publishing experience? What do you appreciate more about your job now that you're a published author?"
Well, among other things, I appreciate the work of publicists even more than I used to. In all seriousness, I appreciate the role of everyone in the publishing industry, as editors, publicists, salespeople, the emotional connection that drives all of this, the emotional connection between author and editor, author and publicist. And the emotional connection between all those people and the book. I mean, you know, it is, I have been passionate for the books I have edited, but to feel that passion for a book that I wrote is, it makes the job way more fulfilling. I want to, it sounds corny, I want to keep giving back the kind of joy that my wonderful team at Riverhead has given me.
So Ian asks, "Hi Daniel, congrats on the book. It's beautiful. I know you first and foremost as an editor, and I'm wondering so he asks the same question, but then says, how does being an editor affect the writing process for you? After you drafted your book, what was it like handing it off to another editor? Difficult, natural, terrifying?"
Being an editor helped me write the book in the sense that it gave me more comfort revising. I think I knew to rewrite huge chunks of the book and that wasn't scary. I think if I wasn't an editor, I think that whole like kill your darlings thing of Faulkner, that becomes much harder if you haven't been the person killing other people's darlings for many years. made my authors sort of do a lot of work, rewrite the last third of the book, you know, whatever. And so whether that was my own desire to rewrite something, or my agent telling me something had to be rewritten, or my editor telling me something rewritten, it never scared me. It was always felt just like the necessary, clear next step. And
were there major structural changes in terms of how the book, or was it always sort of this kind of envelope?
Well, originally, before it was Hades, I was trying to write way back when, before I had a first draft. I wanted it to be a realist novel, just 1970, right. Maybe a bit of 1986. I couldn't really decide, but there was no concept of the underworld originally, and that was the thing that opened the book to me when I realized that that was how it needed to be told. Without that discovery, it would never have been written.
You know what's funny for me? When I read the book, it read like a realist novel to me, in the sense that it wasn't like when we got to the magical parts that it was like, oh, now we're entering into it. It seemed like this, everything was concrete, including the underworld, to me, which I thought was very unsettling and effective.
I love that. I mean, because the underworld in this book is one in which you basically relive the worst moments of your life. It is not, there's no hellfire, there's nothing that crazy. It's just, you are forced to experience the awful things you experience and to confront the choices you made that you believe were wrong, and to see those forks in the proverbial road. And I wanted it to feel both magical in some ways, but also just what it feels like to meditate in your own interior dreamscape on the wrong decisions you can make in your own life.
Yeah. Yeah. It was, I mean, it felt utterly organic to the character and the situation, in a way that there was no slippage, in sort of no being kind of jolted out of the narrative. It all felt natural. Sandra lives in Spain and wants to know if the book is going to be sold there.
I hope so. TBD, my agent is watching. But I'll leave it at that. We'll see. I hope so.
All right, great. And this is more of a comment from Ida Benavides. I'm from Argentina and lived those years. There was censorship and nobody knew what was going on the first years. We moved to the States in 1998.
Yeah, I mean, I did not live those years. So, of course, so much of what my version of this story is based on is what I've read and, what people who did live through those years have told me. I think what people knew varied according to their household, their economic class, so many different things. The same way that today people in certain parts of the world, certain parts of the U.S. believe certain facts and certain people in parts of the U.S. believe other facts. I remember in a very early conversation with
no idea what you're talking about.
I remember a very early conversation with my half brother, who said to me that he remembered hearing on the radio that there was this gunfight with terrorists, and that all of the terrorists had been killed. No one was taken prisoner, or it would be the reverse, that all the terrorists escaped, and that it was, there was something off, or one time you'd hear someone on the radio talking about anti-military things, and then a few weeks later you'd find out on the radio that person had been killed. And so there definitely was censorship. I mean, it wasn't like out in the open what was happening, but it was also clear enough to at least some people, if they were paying attention in certain circles, is what I would say.
There's also something that happens with the narrator. Tomas sort of, like, you kind of get the sense that he thinks he has a better understanding of what's going on and what he's asking for than he does, right? As he sort of submerges into this world. And which is, I think, very effective. There's another question, which was about whether your investigation into your half-sister's true history ever felt stifling to your creative process, or was it always a launch pad into this story?
That's a great question. I think before I really got started with the book, it was stifling. When I sort of felt determined to view Isabel as a purely good ethical force, it was very hard to create a character that wasn't flat because people aren't pure ethical forces. And so for a long time, yeah, I tried writing this book. I tried writing other versions of similar book that I could not get off the ground because I was trying to just write a hero. And that's not interesting and not true to life. And so only once I let go of that belief, or not belief, that objective, and trying to just find out who she really was and learn both the good and the bad about her, then it was really a launch pad.
Bronwyn Scott McCharron says, something that really struck me about the novel was the juxtaposition of actual facts. For example, Audemars is being an actual detention torture center, the character inspired by Alfredo Astiz, the blonde angel of death, among others, with the dreamlike quality of Tomas's journey through Hades, where even we as readers find ourselves doubting the veracity of his jumbled memories. On a somewhat related note, I really appreciated you tackling Peronism here. So many novels about Argentina during this period ignore it entirely. I loved how you described it. Like poetry, it can't be explained, only recognized.
Thank you. I mean... In terms of the juxtaposition of actual facts and sort of the dreamlike stuff, another way that the aspect of the underworld and sort of re-experiencing it in some ways also similarly allowed me to write it more truly, more accurately, in the sense that these are nightmarish, hellish places. And I think I felt, sort of like in the last question, did I feel stifled by the research? Sometimes I did when I was trying to simply show nothing but the reality of a place like Alto Motores, without showing the way it literally warps someone's interior world. You know, I felt like I could never write a third person book, I don't think. If I were trying to just write an objective third person viewpoint about Alto Motores, it would be the stalest depiction of it imaginable, because it's like this place that does not exist for me without the horrifying, warping evil that is happening and that is sort of like twisting someone's mind. So that's why those two things blended for me and blended sort of, I hope, well.
I think that, you know, reading, I was struck by this is bit on Michael Hare's Dispatches, which is like the great book of the Vietnam War. And John Sack was a brilliant journalist, war correspondent, talked about how, you know, the thing that made Michael Hare as a journalist different and better than others. Like he said, you know, John Sack, he'd be out in the field, he'd be with the grunts, and he'd get exhausted and he'd start sort of losing track of things and feel his mind slipping just from the intensity of it, the exhaustion and the terror. And then he'd need to sort of, you know, go back and take some rest, and then, you know, so that he could sort of pin everything down in the way that a good journalist is supposed to. And he said, but what Hare understood as a journalist was that the experience of being out there, of losing track of things, of going insane, was actually the part of the really vital thing about understanding what was actually happening. And, you know, he said he donated his sanity to the cause of journalism. Right. And I felt that, you know, there was something in the way that we enter this world and the way that we get it refracted through what it's done to the narrator, I thought was very effective.
Thanks. Yeah. And that is a great quote, donating my sanity to the cause.
Yeah. The interviewer who interviewed Sack later asked Hare, it mentioned that to Hare, and Hare was like, yeah, I guess I did, you know, go insane to write that book. Maria Newman asks if people from Argentina have read it in your family and what those responses have been.
A lot of people in my family have read it. Most of all, my father, for whom this is probably most painful. And he actually did his own translation of it into Spanish. And, you know, I think the reception in my family has been, this is painful. This is hard to experience. Some members of my family have been sort of unable to read it. Others, I think, even if they're unable, and even those who are unable to read it, and I think feel very glad it's out there, largely because, you know, my half-sister Isabel was disappeared, and she had not had any kind of memorial or funeral, nothing, you know, that's what being disappeared means. And there was no recognition of what had happened to her until in a very long process, we identified her remains and interred them in 2019. But the other sort of memorial to her, I hope, that's sort of the dream, of course, is this book. And so I think for people who even are too pained to read it or come or do find a lot of pain in reading it, they feel, I think good in revisiting some of these wounds and in reckoning with something that historically and culturally they were not really encouraged to reckon with, and also to just see an homage to someone who had not had one and who deserved one.
That's great. I think we only really have time maybe for just one more question. So Blake Rutledge asks, given that the novel deals with guilt and the injustices that are propagated by structures that are systemic and exist beyond the individual, do you think that guilt is primarily an individual experience, or can it be experienced communally? Is there such a thing as collective guilt?
Great question. Absolutely. There is such a thing as collective guilt, I believe. I think, you know, the word that in reviews and that has come up in this conversation a lot is complicity. And the guilt of complicity, which is, or rather the crime of complicity, is perhaps the one that is most frequently partaken in by people to just not care about the injustice around them. And that injustice builds over time, collects, and I think definitely as a result of what happened, you know, as a result of all of that collective complicity, then there is collective guilt as a result of that. I think in a very small way, like I think part of like the trauma of something like, you know, the 2016 election was so many of us felt we just hadn't done enough to actually, you know, there's so many examples of that. And yes, there's the wound of discovering that, you know, half the country likes Trump or whatever, but there's also the wound that we as a society allowed this to happen. And I think maybe that's like a micro version of communal guilt, and that a country like Argentina has a far deeper sense of communal guilt around what happened in the 70s. But yeah, I definitely think that collective guilt is a real thing.
Thank you so much. I just want to very quickly say as the last thing, this conversation has been great. I've really enjoyed it. It probably makes the book sound very heavy. I want to just emphasize, it is a beautiful book, and that's very important. And it is a hard won, carefully wrought and honest beauty that comes from somebody approaching a very difficult subject with a real kind of rigor and empathy and sort of ethical sensibility. And so I really do encourage you to read it and experience it, because it's remarkable.
Thank you so much, Phil. And I was just going to say that, because I do see that there are other questions, and this is going to be my plug to come to other events, especially friends of mine who didn't get to ask your questions. But No, I appreciate that a lot, Phil. And yeah, I mean, that's sort of, again, why I opened with the passage I did, which is, you know, a lot of, I think, to me, one of the most important parts of this book that I hope people understand is that normal people dealing with falling in love, with humor, with getting drunk at a college party, end up in a resistance against a dictatorship. And you know, there is, Tomas isn't just reliving horrors. He's also reliving some of his fondest memories, in that this is when he was closest to someone he was in love with. And yeah, so I appreciate you pointing that out, that there is some joy in this book, I hope, as well.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Phil. Thank you, Greenlight. And even if you've bought this book already, I hope, you know, Greenlight's my local bookstore. They're the best. Do get something from them.
Thank you so much, Daniel and Phil, for tonight's lovely conversation. And thank you to everyone who shared this space with us tonight and asked all your wonderful questions. A reminder, like everyone said, that you can buy the book at Greenlight. If you're local to Brooklyn, we're open noon to 7 daily. And you can also shop at greenlightbookstore.com for local pickup or for shipping anywhere within the U.S. And you can also get your hands on a signed copy of Hades Argentina while supplies last. Those are in stock at our Fort Greene store, and you can also order online. And just make sure to make your signed book request in the order comments field at checkout. Also, a reminder, in case you missed any part of tonight's event or you just want to indulge in a rewatch, that it'll be up on our YouTube channel, Greenlight Bookstore, within the next couple of days. So keep an eye out on our social channels for that. Thank you so much, everyone, again, and have a wonderful rest of your evening. Bye.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Greenlight Bookstore podcast. We're grateful to our production partners at Libro FM for working with us to produce the quarantine season. Libro FM provides access to thousands of digital audiobooks through partnerships with independent bookstores nationwide. You can purchase Libro FM audiobooks at greenlightbookstore.com. You can subscribe to the Greenlight Bookstore podcast on iTunes, download it as a free audiobook from Libro FM, or stream it on greenlightbookstore.com/podcast. On the Greenlight website, you can also find links to purchase the books discussed in this episode and many more, as well as information about Greenlight's store locations and shopping hours. The best way to support your local independent bookstore and the literary communities we serve is as simple as buying a book.